asset-backed finance has garnered much attention in the last several years. Driven by trends like bank retrenchment and investor demand for income and diversification, the asset class has experienced rapid growth, and it's been hailed as a core part of what's being branded as private credit 2.0. Despite this newfound popularity, a number of questions remain, from how to properly define the asset class to how it may perform through a cycle.
There's still a lot of confusion on what asset-backed finance means. What does that universe entail, and what are the various diverse asset classes that are included under the hood of asset-backed finance?
That was Yulia Alexeeva, head of consumer ABS at Barings. And this is Streaming Income, a podcast from Barings. I'm your host, Greg Campion. Coming up on the show, demystifying asset-backed finance. Before we get into it, just a quick reminder that you can follow Streaming Income on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and if you want the full video episodes on YouTube as well. With that, here's my conversation with Yulia Alexeeva. Yulia Alexeeva, welcome to Streaming Income.
Nice to see you, Greg.
Excited to have you here. I feel like this has been a long time coming. I've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time, so this is great that we are finally getting to do it. And since it's your first time on the show, I thought maybe we could just start with a quick intro. I think our listeners would love to hear just a little bit about your role here at Barings and maybe what you were doing beforehand.
My name is Yulia Alexeeva. I head our consumer ABF business here at Barings. I started my career in accounting and audit, qualified as a chartered accountant. That was in Russia, in Cyprus, with PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I really liked the precision of it. But what I quickly realized that it's very backward-looking in nature, and I wanted to do something more forward-looking where I can be the decision-maker, where I can really get closer to investing, to getting deals done, rather than ensuring that it's all accounted for correctly. Mm-hmm. And so that brought me to the U.S., couple years doing my MBA at Wharton, which ultimately led to me entering the ABS banking world. And that's really where I spent time understanding how transactions work, how the collateral is valued, how it performs, how the deals are syndicated. And after a couple of years doing that, I was ready to put on my investor hat mm-hmm. and move on. And ultimately, you know, when I switched to Barings Babson at the time, I was investing in a lot of the same deals that I previously helped create, packaged, and mm-hmm. distribute. So it was great being on the other side because, you know, you can see both sides of the coin. And I would say ABF initially attracted me as a space that is probably one of the most complex and innovative corners of the financial markets. And it's certainly something that I've been appreciating over the years of doing this. It's very non-formulaic. It's not plain vanilla. You have to understand people, processes, structures, waterfall, sort of scenario analysis. There's definitely no shortage of intellectual stimulation. Mm-hmm. And so it does require you to roll up your sleeves to get into the weeds. It does require you to bring your whole brain mm-hmm. to the table, your left side and your right side, your analytical and your creative mm-hmm. intuitive, mm-hmm. and really combine them in order to be able to figure out how everything works.
I love the way that you kind of positioned that just in terms of when you're thinking about asset-backed finance, like using both sides of your brain, right? And like, I think that's really interesting way to think about it because this market does require creativity and structuring with a lot of the transactions that happen. And there's a certain degree of complexity. And I guess that's the reason why we're doing this episode today and why we want to kind of demystify, so to speak, asset-backed finance. So maybe let's start there. I'd like to start kind of high level and just talk about asset-backed finance. I'd be interested in just if you can help us kind of like define our terms a little bit. So help us think about like, what is asset-backed finance? How do you think about that overall universe today? Maybe we can start there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the right place to start because there's a lot of jargon being used. Mm-hmm. Asset-backed finance, asset-backed securities, securitized credit, structured finance, specialty finance, they all technically refer to the same concept and the same thing. And so in simple terms, I think of asset-backed finance as a form of lending secured by a pool of assets with contractual cash flows. And so those assets can be mortgages, can be auto loans, student loans, credit card receivables, but it's really the process of how you make real-world cash flows, mm-hmm. including things like planes and trains and even cell phone bills, and convert them into investable instruments, which basically, you know, makes the cost of funding cheaper across the ecosystem. That's the biggest benefit. And all that to say that asset-backed finance is touching so many parts of what you're looking at, the buildings, you know, the planes, the containers that, you know, cross the oceans to get goods to us on a daily basis. And so asset-backed finance has been playing a very critical part of the global market and the credit ecosystem. And just to kind of break it down even further, I simplistically think that ABS, with the securities component in the end, is the public portion of it. It's the broadly syndicated, it's the liquid market. You know, it does have the liquidity because it has broader market reach. Mm-hmm. It's typically underwritten and distributed by broker dealers. It comes in public or 144A format, but that is typically coming up for investors in conversation about fixed income allocations because it does provide yield enhancement versus treasuries or corporates. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, ABF is typically the private portion of the asset-backed credit market. And so what that means, these are non-public transactions. They are privately negotiated, typically bilaterally. Sometimes there is a small club of investors that participates. And so you have more ability to influence structures. Mm-hmm. You have more ability to influence terms and pricing, which you don't necessarily have on the public side where you're more of a risk taker rather than risk maker. And so that comes typically in 4A2 format. A lot of it is buy to hold type of investments because there is no inherent secondary liquidity afterwards. And so private ABF typically comes up in conversation around private credit, around real assets, around alternatives, because it provides the yield enhancement component to more traditional parts of private credit markets.
I love that context. So you've got the kind of public side, the more kind of securitized ABS side, the private asset backed. As you look at all of the different things that are being securitized and that come under this broad umbrella of asset backed finance, can you just name a few of those? Because I think it's kind of a little bit of a moving target. Like some managers put this asset class under ABF, some don't. But like maybe like is you just thinking that broad brush, like what's under that umbrella high level?
Yeah, you're spot on, Greg. I think there's different ways to kind of divide the world or think about it. So we at Barings use four verticals to kind of just standardize and put it in explainable pockets, right? Okay. That we can underwrite based on underlying risk. So the first one is consumer ABS. And so that is really any asset that's backed by consumer credit where you're effectively underwriting to a borrower's FICO. Okay. So I'm going to name a couple of things. It's not an exhaustive list, but credit card receivables, student loans, auto loans, healthcare or medical loans, timeshare, solar loans, home improvement loans, unsecured personal loans, residential pace, and I can go on. But I think you kind of get the gist of it.
Consumer exposure broadly, and maybe we'll get to it, but that would be interesting to hear like what you're seeing around some of those trends at this moment, given what's going on in the economy. But continue, we'll come back to that.
Very timely and relevant. Yeah. We can unpack that.
Yep.
The second vertical is commercial ABS. And so those are pools that are backed by assets with business loan or underlying business lease component. Yeah. So once again, that has evolved in breadth over time, but it includes things such as all facets of transportation, aircraft receivables, you know, planes and underlying leases, containers, trains, franchise receivables, any sort of royalty streams, digital infrastructure, pharma securitizations, you know, more recently music royalties. So the list, once again, is continuing to expand, but you're not looking through to an individual person with a FICO on the repayment of your debt. That's the biggest distinction between consumer and commercial on the ABF side. Then the third one is residential. Mm-hmm. And so that's really residential mortgages. I think prime, you know, subprime, non-QM, post-GFC, home equity lines of credit, et cetera. So the underlying is obviously linked to a house, which makes it very distinct. It's a, you know, huge part of the economy. And that has evolved tremendously since we've learned a lot of lessons post the GFC. And then last but not least, the fourth vertical, the way we kind of think about it, is the commercial mortgage-backed vertical. So it is more closely aligned to real estate, but it effectively includes three flavors: conduit transactions, which is a hodgepodge or mix of multiple underlying loans; single asset, single borrower transactions, which is more distinct, sort of isolated type of, you know, place; and then CRE CLOs, which is more transitional properties and shorter in nature. But all of those are supported by various property types. So office, retail, industrial, multifamily, logistics, you know, data centers as of more recently. So this is how we define it. And I think you do want to have centers of excellence, because the way you underwrite you know, a pool of 20 aircraft is going to be massively different from the way you underwrite thousands of auto loans, just in terms of using, understanding different regulation, using different assumptions and performance drivers, using more quantitative versus some more qualitative overlays in your work.
I mean, the thing that jumps out to me is just how broad the universe is. Like you mentioned up front, like, ABF kind of touches everything around you, whether it's these buildings or aircraft or, you know, so many different things. But when you hear that description and the four verticals that you described it in, by the way, I'm immediately thinking, okay, this needs to be a white paper. And so like we need to put this out so people can like visualize it. But it seems like it's a really broad-based, you get a really broad-based view of the economy, both consumer and commercial, across this space. So that jumps out to me, and then fully take your point that like it's a different animal trying to underwrite an, you know, a music royalty versus a credit card receivable or something like that. But let's come back to a couple of those points. But maybe before we do that, can we just talk a little bit about the momentum that this space has had recently? So thinking back, you know, we've all seen probably over the last 10 to 15 years the massive growth in the kind of middle market direct lending space, right? And it seems like one of the popular things to do out there these days is to call like, what's the next direct lending, right? What's private credit 2.0 is being used as a term to kind of brand a lot of different asset classes. I'd be interested in just hearing your views on like, what is it that is driving, I guess, so much traction and this kind of increased notoriety of asset-backed finance in recent years?
Yeah, you're spot on. I think every private credit conference this day has definitely a panel on asset-backed, and it's typically called the next frontier of private credit.
Next frontier, yeah.
Yes, not surprisingly so. So a couple things, the way I think about it, and maybe going a little bit to the era post-GFC, what happened with the bunch of new regulation that was put in place to provide guardrails around the asset class, it also created a lot of constraints for banks in lending based, you know, to securitize credit.
Sure.
And so we've seen continued bank retrenchment. And so that created a void, that created a liquidity gap for non-bank entities to step in and provide capital, provide financing where otherwise you wouldn't have, you know, an alternative traditional option. Mm-hmm. So that has continued over the last 10, 15 years. And I think, you know, now the banks are much more focused on their balance sheet efficiency. So I think the banks are much more deliberate and intentional with how they think about deposit volatility lately, which also leads to the fact that, you know, for some assets, alternative lenders are better positioned to provide that. On the demand side, the most important piece of the puzzle that's new and has emerged over the last few years is the interest from the insurance channel. And so if you think about insurance companies, typically, you know, life insurance, long-dated investment, you want to match it from an asset liability matching perspective with long-dated investments. But since effectively 2022, we've seen a massive surge in annuity sales, and they are a shorter product. And so that's why insurance companies have been very focused on finding, you know, higher yielding opportunities to match those shorter tenors. And guess where you find a lot of that? You know, ABS and specifically consumer asset-backed credit, which tends to be shorter in nature. It's faster, it amortizes over time as people pay down their financial obligations. And you can still pick up complexity premium associated with it. It does provide lower correlation to other parts of portfolios insurance companies already have in place, which tend to be investment grade quality in nature. You know, they are high quality portfolio, and you have structures that provide you with that sort of higher quality tilt, you know, more downside protection. So it's not been surprising to see insurance capital really step in to the private ABF world with more appetite in recent years. And then the last thing I'll say is even pension funds, now that a lot of them have reached overfunded status, they are now in a position where they can de-risk out of equities that have become rich or out of credit into, you know, pockets of less liquid markets where they can get the additional illiquidity premium that will compound over time. So I think bank retrenchment, insurance stepping in, and then all the other participants in the market getting interested in this sort of like more complex, nuanced space that have been a little bit underappreciated over time.
You mentioned earlier in your description of the asset class, sort of the public market side of things and the private market side of things. Can we just talk a little bit more about that? Because I know there's a lot going on there. We see, including some of the content that Barings has put out, the kind of theme of like the blurring of lines, so to speak, between public and private credit. Maybe talk a little bit about that. And I'd be curious kind of if you're seeing that blurring today. And then like, are there any examples? Like, I think you and I have talked before about you know, issuers that maybe go between public and private markets. And tell me a little bit about that because, you know, Barings obviously is very active on both sides of that. So I'd just like to hear your kind of high level thoughts on that blurring of lines trend.
Yes, blurring of the lines is, I think, is one of my most commonly frequently used phrases this year. So the convergence between public and private credit, you know, is ongoing. The way it pertains to asset-backed or asset-based finance world is that typically you have a pool of assets underlying collateral and you can package it or structure it any way you want. You can finance it in a bilateral fashion or you can go to broadly syndicated market, but underlying is the same. What we've seen is that over time, the originators of assets tend to value to different things. Some value sort of execution, and they don't want to take the risk of going to the public markets, particularly, you know, maybe at a more challenging time where you might not get a deal priced, right? They are reliant on the certainty of that cash flow to support their business for you know, going concern reasons. They might lean more into private space. You know, some originators might just be too early stage to be able to tap capital markets. So they need to sort of gestate in more private format, build more track record, build more history, build more standardization, and then they'll evolve and graduate into capital markets. So there's a lot of scenarios where I think the important piece is if you understand the whole ecosystem, if you understand the valuation of the assets, the packaging becomes a secondary item, right? And you sort of, you can figure out which format is the more optimal based on the market conditions, based on the borrower needs, you know, based on our client needs as well. And so you can structure something that works in the best way possible, given fluidity in the market. And back to the illiquidity premium that we've talked about, you know, all things being equal, if you're getting the same pricing in public and private markets, that means you're not getting compensated for illiquidity on the private side.
Sure.
So I think managers that have ability to play both parts of the equation, that have two levers to pull and can nimbly move based on the relative value shift across public and private formats will always capitalize on that momentum. So that, I think, is becoming a competitive advantage versus people who only have one lever, who just do private or just do public. And I think that convergence becomes much more pronounced. In many cases, we are witnessing processes where the conversations are happening on both sides. And ultimately, sort of in the last minute, you know, they'll decide which format makes sense. Yeah. And so sometimes it's plan B, sometimes plan B becomes plan A, right? Mm. Like we're going through very turbulent markets right now. Mm. I think we're going to see some of those situations pop up where, you know, decisions will need to be made. And sometimes public markets will not be the most optimal, best price, and, you know, certain way forward.
Interesting. And I know that recently, in the last year or so, there was some kind of changes in terms of how your team was set up and structured, probably due to the way the market's evolving. You want to comment on that a little bit?
Exactly, yeah. So we are following this convergence of public-private. And what we've done is we've combined our public and our private securitized groups into a single $70 billion private placements and asset-based finance platform, which now spans all of the sectors and all of the formats that we've talked about. I think it's really sort of in the spirit of times that we are doing that because we do want to be able to harness that relative value shift across markets for our clients. Mm-hmm. We do want to be able to capitalize on the growth in private asset-based finance. If you look at the estimates of, you know, based on McKinsey Private Credit Report, they're expecting private ABF to grow to north of $20 trillion across securitized credit and consumer finance in the future, which is larger than the public investment grade and high yield markets. So the opportunity, the scale of the opportunity ahead of us is massive. And so that's why I think that continued momentum to grow the private side in addition, or I guess in parallel with the public side, will continue. I don't think we're nowhere near the point where one market will cannibalize the other. It's just right now the size of the pie, you know, continues to increase. And so part of what we've done is we've converged, we've merged the groups, and so we're better able to serve our clients. And I think what's important to stress is that gives us the ultimate ability to customize for client needs. And so what I mean by that, clients can decide where in the rating spectrum they want to play, all the way from AAA to high yield to residuals. ABF now provides them the whole blend across the structure.
Sometimes these huge numbers, like the 20 trillion, like it's hard to get your head around. But like when you think about all of the different segments of the market that you mentioned and that are part of this universe, and then you think about just the broad growth that we're seeing in private assets overall. And that's, I would think that's, you could define that probably as a mega trend that investors just broadly have gotten much more comfortable with private assets over time. It seems like that's still only going in one direction. It makes sense that this will continue to grow. And then I think when you talk about some of the benefits in terms of being customizable, both from an investor point of view, but also from an issuer point of view, it does make a ton of sense. And to me, it's really interesting to think about that issuer perspective as well, especially as you move into these like more potentially turbulent times that we're seeing right now. And you need to be a lot smarter around when you're issuing, where you're issuing, the terms you're getting. And so, to have all of that together, and not to make this too much of a Barings commercial, but to have all of that together and to be able to partner with managers who can look through see the whole kind of picture there seems super important right now.
So. Exactly. And I think the time is very important. Like the reason why ABF is also garnering additional attention is people compare and contrast it to corporate credit. And so if you think about the underlying risk in corporate credit, you lend to a single entity, right? And so you're kind of relying on the business plan, on the execution of that business plan. Whereas in asset-backed, you are lending against a diversified, granular, transparent pool of assets. You know, think thousands of auto loans that, you know, were created last year. So you don't have a single point of failure. That diversification you know, becomes important. It offsets a lot of risk. And then as we are potentially getting to an environment where we might see more defaults and more bankruptcies, the legal structure of asset-based finance, which relies on creating bankruptcy remote vehicles that ring fence the assets and separate them from the sponsor, from the issuing entity, is going to become increasingly more important. It's going to help in workout situations. You know, I think that's a critical component of how securitization plumbing works that sometimes also goes a little bit underappreciated. But, you know, I've personally seen it time and time again. In 2020, we've lived through a number of bankruptcies in the market. And so while the corporate sponsor went down, we've seen the assets that were in those securitization trusts continue to perform, continue to maintain their investment grade ratings, AAA ratings. And so I think that bifurcation has become very visible. And once again, is sort of part of the concept why securitization is such a brilliant idea, right? And so legging into that right now makes more sense. And then the last thing I'll say is, with inflation concerns being top of mind, I do think asset-backed finance provides a great inflation hedge. So once again, if you compare it to corporate credit, if inflation spikes, typically profit margins get squeezed unless you can pass 100% of that through to the consumer, which in many cases is just not feasible. Consumer can only take so much, right? And
we're seem like we're going to be testing how much the consumer can take.
But in asset-based world, the values of assets sometimes hold their value or sometimes increase in value. And once again, a classic example was in post-COVID world, supply chain disruptions really affected prices of auto vehicles. And we've seen 20-25% appreciation for used vehicle prices in a single year because of scarcity impact. Yeah. So those assets were backing the asset-backed deal. So once again, very different dynamics where you have that inflation hedge just by the virtue of appreciating assets underneath the structure.
Okay. Well, I'd like to get your view on opportunities and risks, and especially, I think the risks, some of which you've alluded to already, are worth diving into a little bit because just everything we're seeing in markets recently. So let's start with, are there areas that you're excited about as you look forward, let's say the next 12 to 24 months?
Yeah. So I guess I'll preface it by saying that if you think about ABF from an asset class perspective, I think the biggest shift that will happen is that it will become a strategic allocation for a lot of investors, not necessarily an opportunistic allocation.
So you think it is, in that respect, sort of becoming the next direct lending in some ways?
It's transitioning to become a core building block of private credit portfolios. I think that's underway, and that will probably accelerate in the near term. So that's one thing. Second, if you look at macro, a lot of what we've talked about, structural protections, will become more important. We haven't, you know, really dug into some technicalities, but there's a lot of things that will protect investors on the asset-based side. You have over-collateralization, you have credit enhancement, you have excess spread, you have performance triggers, reserve accounts, cash traps. I mean, I can name a lot of things.
This will all be in the white paper, folks, eventually when we produce it. Yes.
The whole idea is those are things that insulate you or shield you from losses. So sometimes, you know, I get asked this question, like, consumers under a lot of stress, does it mean everything's going to underperform? And the answer is delinquencies and defaults do not necessarily translate to losses if you've structured it appropriately, right? So the key will be conservatively underwriting to be able to weather a recessionary scenario and still be money good. And that's possible, and that's been done before. And I think that's what really sophisticated investors are focused on right now.
Okay.
Specific sectors, I think consumer, despite the fact that there is a lot of pressures coming up and compounding over time from tariffs, is still 2/3 of the U.S. economy. It's still a massive opportunity. And I think if prices of everything go higher, there's still going to be, you know, a meaningful financing need. But the key is to be a smart investor and not underwrite to optimistic assumptions, not to have recency bias where you're forming your view just based on the last few years of very positive performance, which was unusual and artificial because of ultra low rates, because of fiscal stimulus, et cetera. Those vintages, I would say, were outliers. You need to have a through the cycle view going forward. I think in commercial ABS, there is a lot of interesting new and evolving asset classes that will continue growing in significance, a lot of digital infrastructure, for example. I think that'll be another theme which is sort of fueled by AI tailwinds. But you have to be cautious. You know, small business loans will potentially have the same issues as the consumer segment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we are constructive on housing. You know, it has been a very strong point, a great relative value when we look at it across all of the sectors. And once again, I think that's something with the right structure that will perform very well and has evolved over time, you know, post GFC to be a very different, very resilient kind of product into the future. So a lot of places to play in. I think the key point I would make is that investors still remain under allocated to asset-backed credit. And as other parts of the market are becoming more correlated, this is still one unique pocket where you find less correlated income streams, return drivers, and just ability to find opportunities that will not perform the same exact way as the rest of the market, which, you know, I think is becoming very top of mind.
Yes, we've seen some things tend to move toward correlation of one when markets are very turbulent,
exactly,
don't they? You've alluded to some of the risks along the way, but anything else you would want to highlight in terms of, you know, keep you up at night sort of things, or at least things that we want to think about mitigating, other risks that we want to think about mitigating through underwriting or through under other means?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm bullish on ABF, but I'm not blind to the risks. So I'm glad you're asking that question. Right now, what's top of mind for me is just the origination quality and platform risk. And so what I mean by that is what we've seen in GFC and the lessons learned is if underwriting standards loosen beyond reasonable, that's where you're going to start running into problems. Even great structures will not save, you know, bad underwriting underneath. So I think that's what we're watching, you know, making sure that the standards remain robust, that everything's underwritten to ability to repay appropriately. And there are a number of fintech players that have emerged in the last 10 years, but that have not been tested through a cycle environment. And so that to me is always a little bit of a question mark. They're great, innovative business models. You know, a lot of buy now, pay later falls into that. And I think they have performed well in the last decade, but I don't know how they're going to perform in, you know, a very unique GFC type of scenario. So that's top of mind. And then liquidity. I think investors focus on credit risk a lot, but we are seeing rapid shifts in sentiment and market where liquidity can just create those weird aberrations that will impact the asset classes and will inevitably impact the asset-based, you know, world as well. And so that's something that I worry about in an environment that we are finding ourselves in right now.
Well, we are coming to the end of our conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot. Hopefully our listeners have. I feel like this is kind of like chapter one in this conversation to some degree, because I think there is just so much there and so much for us to follow up on. And I think, you know, hopefully we'll be doing more podcasts like this, be doing more, you know, content to help kind of, you know, investors really understand this space, especially as it continues to evolve. Are there any additional resources that you would recommend to people? Anything out there in terms of reading, listening that they want to kind of?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is probably The Big Short by Michael Lewis. I think it's, you know, it's a great book. It's a great movie. And, you know, not to take it lightly, but it does follow, you know, a few people that were seeing the writing on the wall with respect to the subprime housing crisis. And I think the lessons learned from that is that, you know, structures sometimes are too opaque and you really need to have the expertise, the understanding of the data and being able to dissect it and look through, you know, the noise versus the actual, you know, data points and have conviction to invest. And so I think that's why I securitize this. You know, it's a great concept if used appropriately, right?
I see.
And
yeah.
So you need to partner with an experienced manager who has been through multiple cycles, right? I think it's easy to invest in a bull-only market, but really where you grow your expertise is by going through some challenging situations, by doing the workouts, by going through a wave of defaults, by, you know, navigating servicing transfers, you know, restructurings. And so this is where you really cut your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes you smarter as an investor, where you know what can go wrong, not just what's the upside, but, you know, what can really get us and how quickly it can get us. Because I think once the leverage works its way through the system, we've seen in 2008, it can unfold very quickly. So that risk monitoring has to be part of DNA. And so part of investing in that asset class as well. This is why we rely on monthly remittance reports. We see what's happening with the delinquencies. What are the trends? You know, what are the rollovers? What are the recovers, right? Keeping your hand on the pulse of that is very important in a very data-rich, data-heavy sector such as asset-backed finance.
I feel like you answered that question in a very credit manager type of way with their risk mitigation top of mind. So as an investor, I think that's hopefully comforting to hear. This has been great. I feel like I've learned a lot. Hopefully our listeners have as well. And I look forward to hopefully doing more of this in the future. But Yulia, this has been awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great demystifying asset-backed finance with you.
Awesome. Thanks for listening to or watching this episode of Streaming Income. If you'd like to stay up to date on our latest thoughts on asset classes ranging from high yield and private credit to real estate debt and equity, make sure to follow us and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and more. And if you have specific feedback, you can email us at podcast@bearings.com. That's podcast@bearings.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.